Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Look, it's been a great run. It really has. 5 years of a bull market, everybody. But all good things must come to an end, you know. You heard it here first, folks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 14th of July. Great to have you here, everybody, if only to bid farewell to a bull market for the ages. 1,953 days has it been since the Dow hit its post-Lehman Brothers low back in March of 2009. That is, by any measure, a long, long stretch. So how, you might fairly ask, can we tell the end is nigh? Well, here's just one way. With the Dow at record highs, market data shows that professional investment advisors are getting out of equities, that is stocks, at the same time that individual investors, moms and pops, are getting in. Both of them cannot possibly be right. So now what happens? Sally Herships has this one.
Wouldn't it be great if the stock market was just more straightforward? Because when individual investors, the you and me's of the world, wait out an iffy market till stocks seem strong enough to buy, that could mean the market is going to go down, or...
Or, since there's still plenty of people on the sidelines, it could be a sign that the great bull market is going to get even stronger.
James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. He says there are still lots of investors left to start buying stock again. Besides, he says, one of the most frustrating things about forecasting the market is it often overshoots and goes above the fair value of stocks on the way up and below value on the way down. Scott Wren is senior equity strategist at Wells Fargo Advisors.
Money is starting to move in, but I would not agree. When you read some headlines out there that money is pouring in from retail investors, you know, we're not seeing that from our clients.
Wren says there's only a slim chance of another recession in the next couple of years. He expects the bull market to continue through 2016, though a little less bullish. Gregory Miller is chief economist with SunTrust Banks.
Now, the prospect of continued 20% annualized returns may be coming to an end.
Miller says if you are looking for a safe place to park your cash, look for stocks that are tied to the economy, like industrials. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that the bigger a potential market gets, the more of a target for fraud and abuse that market becomes. And so we now turn to the student loan market, $1 trillion in debt outstanding, as you have heard before. 7 million borrowers are apparently now in default on more than $100 billion of that debt, which is why the Illinois Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, filed suit today against two debt settlement companies. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Ever been up late at night and seen those ads on TV promising to help with your student loans?
We can cut your student loan debt in half, or we can completely eliminate your student loan debt.
That's Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan. Her office filed suit today against Broadsword Student Advantage and First American Tax Defense, claiming they tricked borrowers into paying upfront fees for student loan help they didn't provide. Things like promising enrollment in a fake Obama forgiveness program.
You get people who are very excited, very hopeful, pick up the phone, and what they really find out is that these scam artists want their money.
There's a whole new student loan debt relief industry that's popped up in recent years to cash in on the millions of people who are defaulting on their student loans. Persis Yu is a staff attorney with the National Consumer Law Center.
There's a lot of debt. It's very confusing, and I think some borrowers are desperate, and so they're trying to turn to places that look like it might be an easy fix.
She says many of these debt settlement companies mischaracterize government programs as their own, and they charge borrowers as much as $1,600 for services like debt consolidation that are available from the government for nothing. Mike Kantorwitz is a financial aid expert.
What's making this possible is a lack of awareness of repayment options.
He says the government should run an ad campaign of its own so students with debt know what help is available for free. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Adrian says that we deliver. If you are struggling to pay off your student loans, we've got a guide to some of that free help. It's online at marketplace.org/learningcurve. On Wall Street today, like clockwork, could have told you this one. No sooner do we do a death of the bull market story than stocks go higher. Love my job. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Commerce Department ruled on Friday that South Korea is dumping steel pipe into the U.S. market. That is, selling here below their cost, a big global trade no-no. We have a steel company that we check in with from time to time to see how things are going there and in the broader U.S. manufacturing economy. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of Delaware Steel Company. It is, despite its name, in Pennsylvania. Lisa, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai, good to hear from you.
How is business? It's been like, what, 6-8 months since we had you on?
Things are going pretty well. I mean, I would say certainly not as good as they could be, but the economy's moving along. We're chugging along. I think I've told you before, I think it's a slow-moving train, but we're headed in the right direction.
Are you hiring, for instance?
We have not hired a lot. I'm always looking for talented salespeople, and that is very difficult in steel. You need to have a lot of experience and knowledge. I've brought on one administrative position in the last year, and I'll probably look to bring in probably an intern or a young person to get us a little bit more up to stuff with technology and marketing.
Yeah, you got to get like Twitter feeds for your steel stuff, right?
Exactly.
Right, there you go. We were talking, you and I, before we actually turned on the tape recorder here, about this trip I took down to Mississippi and the Severstal steel plant down there. It was part of our series with Jim Fallows in American Futures. And one of the things they told me, which I'm gathering is true on your end as well, is that there's a little bit of a glut in steel now, right? That it's tough to get out there and sell.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word glut that markets are tight.
How about it's a buyer's market, right?
It's both. Right now, you know, pricing's going up and up at the same time as the economy is really improving. So we need, in the United States, we need more steel than we manufacture. So imports are really rising.
Huh.
But on a day-in, day-out basis, I would say the steel mills are squarely in charge, which is probably a good thing. They ought to be. They're the ones with the big capital investment.
Right. So give me your near-term future 6 to 12 months outlook. How are you feeling?
I think we're going to continue to have a better year this year than last year, not as great as I'd like to see it. Somewhere around 2015, most economists and analysts looked at steel and all the related industries and said it'll take us squarely through 2015 before we begin to see some truly strength, you know, real strength in the market.
Wow.
And at the time, it felt like forever. I figured I'd be this old, haggard woman by the time I made it through. But you know what? I'm beginning to see the end of 2015, and we're going in the right direction.
Yeah. Not to pick on you, but do you feel old and haggard after the past 5 years in this economy?
Yeah, a little beat up. Yeah. I would say that it's hard to stay up and be optimistic and hopeful. I am, but it takes an enormous amount of strength and focus. And we're going to come out better on the other side, but with some bumps and bruises.
Lisa Goldenberg, she is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. They are in Fort Washington, PA. Lisa, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
A couple of weeks ago, the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Burwell, said she is going to create two new jobs to run the federal health insurance marketplace, that is healthcare.gov. She's going to hire a chief technology officer, which kind of makes sense given the troubled, shall we say, launch of that website, and also a CEO to have somebody specifically in charge of the thing. There is some speculation that the new CEO could be announced soon, so here's Dan Gorenstein from the Health Desk on what that job might entail.
When you think about it, healthcare.gov is an online store that exists to sell health insurance.
It's a grudge buy.
John Kingsdale was the first guy to run the Massachusetts exchange, the Connector.
Nobody likes to go down to their corner broker's office on a Saturday morning like they do to a car dealer and smell the print on the new 150-page explanation of benefits.
Of course, the federal government's glitchy website only made it harder for consumers to kick the tires on those insurance policies. As last year's fiasco proved, running a public exchange, which covers two-thirds of the states, is uncharted territory for Washington. Kingsdale says, really, it's a more entrepreneurial enterprise than most anything else the government does.
I used to shock my very liberal, left-leaning board of directors at the Connector by reminding them, if you want to talk about enrollment and getting people covered, you're basically talking about marketing and sales.
By announcing plans to hire a CEO, many think HHS Secretary Sylvia Burwell understands this operation requires a business approach with business savvy, which makes sense since this person will work with the state exchanges, consumers, and insurers. Former White House advisor Kavita Patel says if we're going to call this person a CEO, though, we've got to make sure we give them the power of a CEO.
Just like we saw with the healthcare.gov rollout, people didn't have the resources or authority to make the decisions they needed. And in the end, we suffered for it.
While Patel likes the idea of these management changes, it's easy to see how the CEO could get buried in the federal government maze. Not to get too deep into bureaucratic mumbo-jumbo, but this CEO will run what's called the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight, a bureau within the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, a division of HHS.
Imagine taking a new startup organization and putting it inside of IBM, something that's got, 20,000 divisions with 200 senior vice presidents.
In a statement last month, Burwell said the CEO will have a dotted line straight to her. In other words, this new management structure is supposed to help Burwell stay in the loop, poised to move if calamity strikes. Leadership, though, is just one challenge facing the feds as we approach healthcare.gov 2.0.
Let's say you're Aetna, you're Cigna, you're United, or you're Blue Cross. They're in the middle of doing incredibly complicated bids right now for 2015 with lots and lots of open questions.
Tom Scully was a top HHS official under George W. Bush. Scully says the CEO must understand what it's like to develop new insurance policies and how to get consumers to buy them. Someone, he says, who knows the industry inside and out.
You're probably going to know when somebody's crying, screaming at you, whether they're crying wolf or they got a real problem.
John Kingsdale, the former head of the Massachusetts Exchange, says here's the thing. Healthcare.gov is here to stay. He says that means the federal government must do things like enhance the consumer experience and hold insurers' hands or keep their feet to the fire.
As the exchange matures from the startup to this more commercial entrepreneurial phase, this is a chance for the Obama administration to show the government can learn from the private sector.
Kingsdale says the more HHS accepts that it's running a unique online store and has a role as middleman to frequently overwhelmed shoppers and frequently frustrated insurers, the more people get insurance, which he says is the point. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Big news in chocolate today. Yes, chocolate. $1.5 billion deal in which the Swiss chocolatier Lindt will buy Russell Stover out of Kansas City, Missouri, and with it about 9% of the American market. It's often a mystery how these deals come to be done, but our own Stacey Vanek Smith let her imagination run wild.
From Lindtlicious, I'm an international chocolate company with serious goals for expansion into the U.S. market, looking for friendship and possibly merger. No gummy candies, please.
Hey, Lindtlicious. Russell Stover for you here. You sound nice, and I really like the look of your packaging. I make Whitman samplers, you know, what guys buy when they forget it's Valentine's Day but then remember when they're in line at the CVS buying foot spray. That's me. Why don't we get together and I'll show you my chocolate map. I've got everything you need, from orange cream to Roman nougat.
I'm from Switzerland. We have 4 official languages. I don't do chocolate maps.
Well, did I mention I'm the largest maker of box chocolates in the country? I don't speak 4 languages or anything, but together we'd have 9% of the U.S. market.
9%. Sorry for being snobby about the chocolate map. They're fine. You just meet a lot of weirdos out there, you know? What kind of activities interest you?
I'm just a regular guy from Missouri. I enjoy candlelit earnings reports and long PowerPoint meetings about synergy. Someday I'd like to settle down and be bought out by an international company such as yourself. What do you say we meet for coffee?
Sounds great. And I'd love to get a peek at your balance sheet.
Coming up.
It was just a toxic atmosphere. I was thinking, what could you compare it to today? And I think you'd have to look at cities like Beijing. It hurt, literally hurt, to breathe.
Oh no, not Beijing, L.A., because we used to be China, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Bull market, schmull market, right? The Dow up 111 points today, 2/3 of 1%, closed at 17,055. The NASDAQ up 24 points, 0.5%, 4440. The S&P 500 popped 9 points higher, 0.5%, 19.77 there. You know that thing that happens when earnings are disappointing but somehow still, quote, better than expected? Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Citigroup Today. The bank said this morning its trading business did poorly, but not as badly as some investors had feared. Citi also said, as we told you last week, it is going to pay $7 billion to settle an investigation into its mortgage-backed securities business. Well, it turns out investors were listening to us last week, too. They expected that news. Citi stock finished up 3% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Are consumers hitting the malls for the air conditioning, or are they actually spending money? In Washington, the Commerce Department reports retail sales data for June. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee holds a hearing on wildfire preparedness, and Yahoo is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've seen those pictures of air pollution over in China, right? If not, it's definitely worth a Google or two because it's terrible. There aren't too many other ways to spin it. The Chinese government says it's working on getting its air under control, but they do have a long way to go. And this being the only planet we have, until China figures it out, anything we do here to cut pollution really makes a difference only at the margins. But right about here, it's worth a mention that not all that long ago, we had our own absolutely horrendous air pollution problems. It's the starting point for our series this week called We Used to Be China. From the Sustainability Desk, here is Sarah Gardner with the history of L.A. smog.
If you live in L.A. long enough, you start thinking of every story as a possible screenplay. Nobody's made L.A. Smog the movie, but you could pitch it as a horror flick, a political thriller, hey, for that matter, a love story with the automobile as a lead character. Chip Jacobs co-wrote the book Smogtown.
It would start on a day, July 1943, hot, broiling day.
Establishing shot, a grim, hazy skyline.
This is the city, Los Angeles, California.
Cut to a series of shots, fumes belching from a wartime aircraft factory, an oil refinery, a traffic jam. Then a foggy fume bank descends on the city.
But it's not like the other periodic smogs. This sucker stays and intensifies and it spreads.
Cut to workers downtown, coughing, wiping their burning eyes. Then an emergency room full of nauseated men, women, and children. Thick smog like this is such a mystery in 1943. Some people suspect
it's a gas attack.
A gas attack?
It must be the Japanese.
It's the Japanese.
That really happened. But the 1943 smog siege wasn't L.A.'s last, and it triggered a long, frustrating battle against air pollution in this country that's still not over.
'Cause I'm taking a trip California way and make the San Fernando Valley my home.
Bing Crosby made L.A. sound like a Garden of Eden, but in reality, it's a pollution trap. The surrounding mountains hem in any dirty air. And in post-war L.A., one of the fastest-growing economies in the world, there was plenty of dirty air. Smoke and fumes from chemical and steel plants, refineries. Oh, and from backyard incinerators. Imagine a city of 2 million people all burning their trash in their backyards. Historian Sarah Elkind.
They saw this as much more sanitary than storing garbage in their yards until it could be collected.
Elkind says early on, at least, the Chamber of Commerce agitated for cleaner air. L.A. had sold itself as a place where nature and industry could thrive side by side, a clean, modern city, not like sooty old Chicago or Detroit.
Yes, this is the land of the rainbow's end, where man lives longer and better and breathes the air of a newfound world.
Instead, smog was making Los Angeles the butt of jokes, so the city created the first air pollution control district in the country. Its first director vowed to clean up the air in 3 years, tops. pollution cops started cracking down on smokestack emissions. One small problem.
Any gains from that were completely overwhelmed by the surge in automobile ownership.
There he comes now in his merry Oldsmobile. It's a futuristic Oldsmobile with the newest push-button features.
By the late 40s, L.A. had more cars than most countries. The idea that these sleek machines could be fouling L.A.'s air, nobody wanted to believe that. Then along came a hero worthy of movie stardom. Enter Ari Hagensmit, a middle-aged biochemist at Caltech who was studying the flavor of pineapples. Okay, Hagensmit was no Superman, but he did save L.A. in a sense. In 1950, he took a year off to study the brownish haze plaguing his beloved Pasadena, and he developed a theory. Jim Lentz is a leading air pollution authority.
Now, in retrospect, it seems like it wasn't too hard, but he must have been a pretty brilliant chemist. He quickly concluded that automobiles were a big part of the problem here in Los Angeles.
Hagensmit discovered an entirely new kind of air pollution, photochemical smog. LA's famous sunshine was cooking emissions from cars and factories to form a dangerous gas, ground-level ozone. That was the stuff stinging people's eyes and making the city smell vaguely of bleach in the summer. The oil companies realized if people blamed smog on refineries and cars, they were in trouble. So they struck back with science they paid for.
And they actually had a member go to Caltech and give a lacerating speech against Hagensmit, patronizing, demeaning. How could such an intelligent man come to such a horrible conclusion?
But by the mid-50s, there was no question. The biggest smog culprit in Los Angeles was sitting in everyone's driveway. But scientific consensus, as we know, doesn't translate into action. And the auto industry stuck to this script.
The science just isn't conclusive.
That's right. Any changes right now would clearly be premature.
Besides, the technology's not even there yet.
And what were they thinking?
This will cost too much money.
Familiar dialogue, isn't it? But by then, the auto and oil industries were among the most powerful in the world. Profits were their business, not public health. But public health was suffering. On the worst days in L.A., ERs overflowed. Parents kept their kids home from school. The city's air pollution czar sat in Hagensmit's plexiglass smog chamber to prove ozone's danger, and he got bronchitis. Jeff Slade grew up in L.A. in the 50s.
It was just a toxic atmosphere. I was thinking, what could you compare it to today? And I think you'd have to look at cities like Beijing. It literally hurt to breathe.
By the late 50s, Angelenos were fed up. Anti-smog groups started sprouting all over the county. Slade's little brother suffered from severe asthma. One year it got so bad he didn't grow. Their mom, a housewife in Beverly Hills, joined a women's protest group called SOS, Stamp Out Smog, media savvy with Hollywood connections.
So they did flashy things. I have a picture sitting here in front of me of my mother with a birthday cake with a skull and crossbones on it that says, Happy Birthday, Smog. And the press just loved this kind of thing.
These ladies even dragged their kids to public hearings wearing gas masks. That kind of political theater may seem routine today, but try to imagine. The word environmentalism wasn't even in the vocabulary yet. Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, had just introduced a scary new thought that technological progress could kill us. By the early 60s, California demanded the first anti-smog controls on cars. Jim Lentz says the early ones were fairly crude.
But the idea was the elected officials here finally believed that cars were a big part of the problem, and we're going to regulate them in spite of what the automobile manufacturers said.
And here's where real life outdazzles the movies. Change happens so fast. In 63, Congress passes the first Clean Air Act. Smog is a national problem now. A few years later, it calls for auto emission standards. Then it lets California set even stricter ones. The Justice Department sues automakers for conspiring to delay anti-smog devices. And finally, says veteran regulator Mary Nichols, the Clean Air Act of 1970.
That said, we're going to set an air quality standard that's based on a public health measurement.
And let the feds decide how to achieve it. That was entirely new, and only one person in Congress voted no. Jim Lentz says in the end, the air got better not because people were willing to change their behavior, but because technology improved. And technology, he says, often needs a big nudge.
My belief has been that humans are very innovative. In fact, my experience was if you push them a little bit, they find solutions. They just don't like to do it because it takes time and costs money, and they don't like to push ahead.
Final scene in L.A. Smog, the movie, Jeff Slade, the guy from Beverly Hills, he comes back to L.A. for a visit after living in New York for years. We see Slade and his wife driving north on L.A.'s famous 405 freeway. He looks down into the San Fernando Valley and spies a beautiful mountain range.
And I said to my wife, what are those mountains? I've never seen those before. And you couldn't see them. You couldn't see them because of the smog.
And the camera pans upwards to a relatively clear L.A. sky. In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Pictures help with a story like this, so we've put together a slideshow of how crazy L.A.'s smog years really were. That is, of course, at marketplace.org. And it would be very cool if you would send us pictures of your city's air, your blue sky, your gray sky, smokestacks, what have you. Post them on Instagram with the hashtag Marketplace Smog Check. We'd appreciate it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, straight from the wires of the Associated Press, Dateline Los Angeles. Customs inspectors seized a live shipment of 67 giant African snails at Los Angeles International Airport this month. 67 snails with a total weight of 35 pounds. That is half a pound apiece or more for snails, apparently from Nigeria, by the way. Experts the AP spoke to say the species of snail is prohibited because A, ew, but also B, they pose a serious threat to agriculture, public health, and the economy. Yes, yes, they do. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.